came up under my elbow, surprisingly firm. "Here," he said quietly. "Let me help. It's slippery underfoot." Chapter 16. On the night that our wedding is on us. "Will you sing for me, Roger?" She stood in the opening of the borrowed tent, facing outward. From the back he could see no more than her silhouette against the grey of the clouded sky, her long hair drifting in the rainy wind. She had worn it unbound to be married. Maiden's hair, though she had a child. It was cold tonight, quite different from that first night together, that hot, gorgeous night that had ended in anger and betrayal. Months of other nights lay between that one and this. Months of loneliness, months of joy. And yet his heart beat as fast now as it had on their first wedding night. "I always sing for you, Hen." He came behind her, drew her back against him, so that her head rested on his shoulder, her hair cool and live against his face. His arm curled round her waist, holding her secure. He bent his head, nuzzling for the curve of her ear. "No matter what," he whispered, "no matter where, no matter whether you're there to hear or not, I'll always sing for you." She turned into his arms then, with a small hum of content in her throat, and her mouth found his, tasting of barbecued meat and spiced wine. The rain pattered on the canvas above, and the cold of late autumn curled up from the ground around their feet. The first time the air had smelled of hops and mudflats, their bower had had the earthy tang of hay and donkeys. Now the air was live with pine and juniper, spiced with the smoke of smouldering fires, and the faint, sweet note of baby shit. And yet she was once more dark and light in his arms, her face hidden, her body gleaming. Then she'd been moist and molten, humid with the summer. Now her flesh was cool as marble, save where he touched it. And yet the summer lived still in the palm of his hand where he touched her, sweet and slick, ripe with the secrets of a hot, dark night. It was right, he thought, that these vows should have been spoken as the first ones had, out of doors, part of wind and earth, fire and water. "I love you," she murmured against his mouth, and he seized her lip between his teeth, too moved to speak the words in reply just yet. There had been words between them then, as there had been words tonight. The words were the same, and he had meant them the first time no less than he did now. Yet it was different. The first time he had spoken them to her alone, and while he had done so in the sight of God, God had been discreet, hovering well in the background, face turned away from their nakedness. Tonight he said them in the blaze of firelight before the face of God and the world, her people and his. His heart had been hers, and whatever else he had. But now there was no question of him and her, his and hers. The vows were given, his ring put on her finger, the bond both made and witnessed. They were one body. One hand of their joint organism crushed a breast a little too hard, and one throat made a small sound of discomfort. She drew back from him a little, and he felt rather than saw her grimace. The air came cold between them, and his own skin felt suddenly raw, exposed, as though he had been severed from her with a knife. "I need," she said, and touched her breast, not finishing. "Just a minute, okay?" Claire had fed the child while Brianna went to make her overtures to Reverend Caldwell. Bursting with porridge and stewed peaches, Jimmy could scarcely be roused to suckle briefly before relapsing into somnolence and being taken away by Lizzie, his wee round belly tight as a drum. That was as well for their privacy. Drugged into such a glutinous stupor, it was unlikely the bairn would wake before dawn. The price of it, though, was the unused milk. No one living in the same house with a nursing mother was likely to be unaware of her breasts, let alone her husband. They had a life of their own, those breasts. They changed size from hour to hour. For the one thing, swelling from their normal soft globes into great round hard bubbles that gave him the eerie feeling that if he touched one, it would burst. Now and then, one did burst, or at least gave that impression. The ridge of soft flesh would rise like kneaded bread, slowly but surely pushing above the edge of Brianna's bodice. Then suddenly, there would be a big wet circle on the cloth, appearing magically, as though some invisible person had thrown a snowball at her. Or two snowballs, for what one breast did, its fellow rushed at once to follow suit. Sometimes the heavenly twins were foiled, though. Jemmy drained one side, but inconsiderately fell asleep before performing the same service for the other. This left his mother gritting her teeth, gingerly taking the swollen orb in the palm of her hand, pressing the edge of a pewter cup just under the nipple to catch the spray and dribble as she eased the aching fullness, enough to sleep herself. She was doing it now, modestly turned away from him, and Alised gathered round her shoulders against the chill. He could hear the hiss of the milk, a tiny chime against the metal. He was reluctant to drown the sound, which he found erotic, but nonetheless picked up the guitar and put his thumb to the strings, his hand on the frets. He didn't strum or strike chords, but plucked single notes, small voices to echo his own, the thrum of one string ringing through the chanted line. A love song, to be sure. One of the very old ones, in the Gaelic. Even if she didn't know all the words, he thought she'd take the sense of it. On the night that our wedding is on us, I will come leaping to thee with gifts. On the night that our wedding is on us. He closed his eyes, seeing in memory what the night now hid. Her nipples were the colour of ripe plums and the size of ripe cherries, and Roger had a vivid mental picture of how one would feel in his mouth. He had suckled them once, long before the coming of Jemmy, but no more. You will get 100 silver salmon, 100 badger skins. She never asked him not to, never turned away, and yet he could tell by the faint intake of her breath that often she was bracing herself not to flinch when he touched her breasts. Was it only tenderness, he wondered? Did she not trust him to be gentle? He shied away from the thought, drowning it in a small cascade of notes, liquid as a waterfall. It might not be you, whispered the voice, stubbornly refusing to be distracted. Perhaps it was him. Something that he did to her. Fuck off, he thought, succinctly to the voice, marking each word with a sharp plucked string. Stephen Bonnet would have no place in their wedding bed. None. He laid a hand on the strings to silence them briefly, and as she slid the Arised from her shoulders, began again, this time in English. A special song, too, one for the two of them alone. He didn't know whether anyone else might hear, but it made no difference if they did. She stood and slid the shift from her shoulders as his fingers touched the quiet opening of the Beatles' Yesterday. He heard her laugh once, then sigh, and the linen whispered against her skin as it fell. She came naked behind him as the soft melancholy yearning of the song filled the dark. Her hand stroked his hair, gathered it tight at the nape of his neck. She swayed, and he felt her press against his back, her breasts soft now, yielding and warm through his shirt, her breath tickling his ear. Her hand rested on his shoulder briefly, then slid down inside his shirt, fingers cool on his chest. He could feel the warm, hard metal of her ring on his skin, and felt a surge of possession that pulsed through him like a gulp of whiskey, a heat suffusing his flesh. He ached to turn and take hold of her, but pushed the urge down, heightening anticipation. He bent his head closer to the strings and sang until all thought left him, and there was nothing left but his body and hers. He couldn't have said when her hand closed over his on the frets, and he rose and turned to her, still filled with the music and his love, soft and strong and pure in the dark. She lay quiet in the dark, feeling the thunder of her heart boom slowly in her ears. The throb of it echoed in the pulse of her neck, her wrists, her breasts, her womb. She had lost track of her boundaries. Slowly the sense of limbs and digits, head and trunk, of space occupied, returned. She moved the single finger glued between her legs and felt the last of the tingling shocks run down her thighs as it slid free. She drew breath slowly, listening. His breath still came in long, regular exhalations. Thank God he hadn't wakened. She'd been careful, moving no more than a fingertip, but the final jolt of climax had struck her so hard that her hips jerked as her belly quivered and convulsed, her heels digging into the pallet with a loud rustling of straw. He'd had a very long day. They all had. Even so, she could still hear faint sounds of festivity on the mountainside around them. The chance to celebrate like this came so rarely that no one would let something so inconsequential as rain, cold, or tiredness keep them from the revels. She herself felt like a puddle of liquid mercury, soft and heavy, shimmering with each heartbeat. The effort of moving was unthinkable, but her final convulsion had pulled the quilt off his shoulders, and the skin of his back lay smooth and bare, dark by contrast with the pale cloth. The pocket of warmth around her was snug and perfect, but she couldn't luxuriate while he lay exposed to the chilly midnight air like that. Tendrils of fog had crept under the tent flap and hung ghost-like and clammy all around them. She could see the faint gleam of moisture on the high curve of his cheekbone. She summoned back the notion of bones and muscles, found a motor neuron in working order, and sternly ordered it to fire. Embodied once more, she rolled onto her side, facing him, and gently pulled the quilt up around his ears. He stirred and murmured something. She stroked his tumbled black hair, and he smiled faintly, eyelids half opening in the blank stare of one who sees dreams. They dropped again, and he took a long, sighing breath and fell back asleep. "I love you," she whispered, filled with tenderness. She stroked his back lightly, loving the feel of his flat shoulder blades through the quilt, the solid knob of bone at the nape of his neck, and the long, smooth groove that ran down the centre of his spine to arch into the swell of his buttocks. A cold breeze rippled the tiny hairs of her arm, and she pulled it back under the covers, letting her hand rest lightly on Roger's bottom. The feel of it was no novelty, but thrilled her just the same, with its perfect warm roundness, its coarse curly hair. A faint echo of her solitary joy encouraged her to do it again, and her free hand crept between her legs. But sheer exhaustion stayed her, limp fingers cupped on the swollen flesh, one languid finger tracing the slickness. She'd hoped it would be different tonight. Without the ever-present danger of waking Jemmy, free to take as much time as they wanted, and riding the waves of emotion from their exchange of vows, she'd thought. But it was the same. It wasn't that she wasn't aroused. Quite the contrary. Every movement, each touch imprinted itself in the nerves of her skin, the crevices of mouth and memory drowning her with scent, branding her with sensation. But no matter how wonderful the lovemaking, there remained some odd sense of distance, some barrier that she couldn't penetrate. And so once more she found herself lying beside him as he slept, reliving in memory each moment of the passion they had just shared, and able in memory at last to yield to it. Perhaps it was that she loved him too much, she thought, was too mindful of his pleasure to take her own. The satisfaction she felt when he lost himself gasping and moaning in her arms was far greater than the simple physical pleasure of climax. And yet, There was something darker under that, a peculiar sense of triumph, as though she had won some undeclared and unacknowledged contest between them. She sighed and butted her forehead against the curve of his shoulder, enjoying the reek of him, a smell of strong and bitter musk, like pennyroyal. The thoughts of Herbs reminded her, and she reached down again, cautiously, so as not to awaken him, and slid one slippery finger deep inside to check. No, it was all right. The slip of sponge, soaked with tansy oil, was still in place, its fragile, pungent presence safeguarding the entrance to her womb. She moved closer, and he moved unconsciously, his body half-turning to accommodate her, his warmth at once enclosing her, comforting her. His hand groped like a bird flying blind, skimming her hip, her soft belly, in search of a resting place. She seized it in both hands and folded it, secure beneath her chin. His hand curled over hers. She kissed one large, rough knuckle, and he sighed deeply, his hand relaxing. The sounds of revelry on the mountain had faded as the dancers tired and the musicians grew hoarse and weary. The rain began again, pattering on the canvas overhead, and grey mist touched her face with cool, damp fingers. The smell of wet canvas made her think of camping trips as a child with her father, with their mingled sensations of excitement and safety. And she nestled deeper into the curve of Roger's body, feeling a similar sense of comfort and anticipation. It was early days, she thought. They had all their lives before them. The time of surrender would surely come. Chapter 17. Watchfire. From where they lay, he could see down through a gap in the rocks, all the way to the watchfire that burned before Hayes's tent. The great fire of the gathering had burned itself to embers, the glow of it faint memory of the towering flames of declaration. But the smaller fire burned steadily as a star against the cold night. Now and then a dark kilted figure rose to tend it, stood stark for a moment against the brightness, then faded back again into the night. He was faintly conscious of the racing clouds that dimmed the moon, the heavy flutter of the canvas overhead, and the rock-black shadows of the mountain slope, but he had no eyes for anything save the fire below and the white patch of the tent behind it, shapeless as a ghost. He had slowed his breath, relaxed the muscles of arms and chest, back, buttocks, legs. Not in an attempt to sleep. Sleep was far from him, and he had no mind to seek it. Nor was it an attempt to fool Claire into thinking he slept. So close against his body, so close to his mind as she was, she would know him wakeful. No, it was only a signal to her, an acknowledged pretense that freed her from any need to pay heed to him. She might sleep, knowing him occupied within the walnut shell of his mind, having no immediate demand to make of her. Few slept on the mountain tonight, he thought. The sound of the wind masked the murmur of voices, the shuffle of movement, but his hunter's senses registered a dozen small stirrings, identifying things half heard, putting names to moving shadows. A scrape of shoe leather on rock, the flap of a blanket shaken out. That would be Hobson and Fowles, making a quiet departure alone in the dark, fearful of waiting for the morning, lest they be betrayed in the night. A few notes of music came down on a gust of wind from above, concertina and fiddle. Jocasta's slaves, unwilling to surrender this rare celebration to the needs of sleep or the imperatives of weather. An infant's thin wail. Wee Jemmy? No. From behind. Tiny Joan, then, and Massali's voice, low and sweet, singing in French. Alouette, gentille alouette. There, a sound he had expected, footsteps passing on the far side of the rocks that bordered his family's sanctuary. Quick and light, headed downhill. He waited, eyes open, and in a few moments heard the faint hail of a sentry near the tent. No figure showed in the firelight below, but the tent flap beyond it stirred, gaped open, then fell unbroken.
As he had thought then, sentiment lay strong against the rioters. It wasn't held a betrayal of friends, but rather the necessary giving up of criminals for the protection of those who chose to live by the law. It might be reluctant. The witnesses had waited for the dark, but not secretive.
Je te plumerai la tête.
It occurred to him to wonder why the songs sung to bairns were so often gruesome, and no thought given to the words they took in with their mother's milk. The music of the songs was no more to him than tuneless chanting. Perhaps that was why he paid more attention than most to the words. Even Brianna, who came from what was presumably a more peaceable time, sang songs of fearsome death and tragic loss to wee Jem, all with a look on her face as tender as the Virgin nursing the Christ child. That verse about the miner's daughter who drowned amidst her ducklings. It occurred to him perversely to wonder what awful things the Blessed Mother might have counted in her own repertoire of cradle songs. Judging from the Bible, the Holy Land had been no more peaceful than France or Scotland. He would have crossed himself in penance for the notion, but Claire was lying on his right arm.
Were they wrong?
Claire's voice came softly from beneath his chin, startling him.
Who?
He bent his head to hers and kissed the thick softness of her curls. Her hair smelt of wood smoke and the sharp, clear tang of juniper berries.
The men in Hillsborough?
Aye, I think so.
What would you have done?
He sighed, moved one shoulder in a shrug.
Can I see? Aye. If it was me that was cheated, and no hope of redress, I might have laid hands on the man who'd done it. But what was done there? You heard it. Houses torn down and set afire. Men dragged out and beaten senseless only for cause of the office they held. No, Sassenach. I canna say what I might have done, but not that.
She turned her head a little, so he saw the high curve of her cheekbone rimmed in light, and the flexing of the muscle that ran in front of her ear as she smiled.
I didn't think you would. Can't see you as part of a mob.
He kissed her ear, not to reply directly.
He could see himself as part of a mob all too easily. That was what frightened him. He knew much too well the strength of it.
One Highlander was a warrior, but the mightiest man was only a man. It was the madness that took men together that had ruled the glens for 1,000 years. That thrill of the blood when you heard the shrieks of your companions, felt the strength of the whole bear you up like wings, and knew immortality. For if you should fall yourself, still you would be carried on, your spirit shrieking in the mouths of those who ran beside you. It was only later, when the blood lay cold in limp veins, and deaf ears heard the women weeping.
And if it wasn't a man who cheated you, if it was the crown or the court, not one person, I mean, but an institution.
He knew where she meant to lead him. He tightened his arm around her, her breath warm on the knuckles of his hand curled just under her chin.
It isn't that. Not here. Not now.
The rioters had lashed out in response to the crimes of men, of individuals. The price of those crimes might be paid in blood, but not requited by war. Not yet.
It isn't, she said quietly, but it will be. Not now, he said again.
The piece of paper was safely hidden in his saddlebag, its damnable summons concealed. He must deal with it, and soon, but for tonight he would pretend it wasn't there. One final night of peace, with his wife in his arms, his family around him.
Another shadow by the fire, another hail by the sentry, one more to pass through the traitor's gate. And are they wrong? A slight tilt of her head toward the tent below. The ones going to turn in their acquaintances. Aye, he said after a moment. They're wrong as well. A mob might rule, but it was single men would pay the price for what was done. Part of the price was the breaking of trust, the turning of neighbour against neighbour. Fear. A noose squeezing tight until there was no longer any breath of mercy or forgiveness. It had come on to rain. The light spatter of drops on the canvas overhead turned to a regular thrum, and the air grew live with the rush of water. It was a winter storm. No lightning lit the sky, and the looming mountains were invisible. He held Claire close, curving his free hand low over her belly. She sighed, a small sound of pain in it, and settled herself, her ass nesting round as an egg in the cup of his thighs. He could feel the melting begin as she relaxed, that odd merging of his flesh with hers. At first, it had happened only when he took her, and only at the last. Then, sooner and sooner, until her hand upon him was both invitation and completion, a surrender inevitable, offered and accepted. He had resisted now and then, only to be sure he could, suddenly fearful of the loss of himself. He had thought it a treacherous passion, like the one that swept a mob of men, linking them in mindless fury. Now he trusted it was right, though. The Bible did say it. Thou shalt be one flesh, and what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. He had survived such a sundering once. He couldn't stand it twice and live. The sentries had put up a canvas lean-to near their fire to shelter them from the rain. The flames sputtered as the rain blew in, though, and lit the pale cloth with a flicker that pulsed like a heartbeat. He wasn't afraid to die with her, by fire or any other way, only to live without her. The wind changed, carrying with it the faint sound of laughter from the tiny tent where the newlyweds slept, or didn't. He smiled to himself, hearing it. He could only hope that his daughter would find such joy in her marriage as he had. But so far, so good. The lad's face lit when he looked at her. "What will you do?" Claire said quietly, her words almost lost in the pattering of the rain.
"What I must."
It was no answer, but the only one. There was no world outside this small confine, he told himself. Scotland was gone. The colonies were going. What lay ahead he could only dimly imagine from the things Brianna told him. The only reality was the woman held fast in his arms, his children and grandchildren, his tenants and servants. These were the gifts that God had given to him. His to harbour, his to protect. The mountainside lay dark and quiet, but he could feel them there all around him, trusting him to see them safe. If God had given him this trust, surely he would also grant the strength to keep it. He was becoming aroused by the habit of close contact, his rising cock uncomfortably trapped. He wanted her, had been wanting for days, the urge pushed aside in the bustle of the gathering. The dull ache in his balls echoed what he thought must be the ache in her womb. He had taken her in the midst of her courses now and then, when the two of them had wanted too urgently for waiting. He had found it messy and disturbing, but exciting too, leaving him with a faint sense of shame that wasn't entirely unpleasant. Now was not the time or place for it, of course, but the memory of other times and other places made him shift, twisting away from her, not to trouble her with the bodily evidence of his thoughts. Yet what he felt now wasn't lust, not quite. Nor was it even the need of her, the wanting of soul's company. He wished to cover her with his body, possess her, for if he could do that, he could pretend to himself that she was safe. Covering her so, joined in one body, he might protect her. Or so he felt, even knowing how senseless the feeling was.
He had stiffened, his body tensing involuntarily with his thoughts. Claire stirred and reached back with one hand. She laid it on his leg, let it lie for a moment, then reached gently farther up in drowsy question. He bent his head, put his lips behind her ear, said what he was thinking without thought.
"Nothing will harm you while there is breath in my body, Aniandone. Nothing."
"I know," she said. Her limbs went slowly slack, her breathing eased, and the soft round of her belly swelled under his palm as she melted into sleep. Her hand stayed on him, covering him. He lay stiff and wide awake, long after the watchfire had been quenched by the rain. Part 2. The Chieftain's Call. Chapter 18. No Place Like Home. Gideon darted out his head like a snake, aiming for the leg of the rider just ahead. Chase! Jamie wrenched the big bay's head around before he could take a bite.
"Evil-minded whoreson," he muttered under his breath.
Geordie Chisholm, unaware of his narrow escape from Gideon's teeth, caught the remark and looked back over his shoulder, startled. Jamie smiled and touched his slouch hat apologetically, nudging the horse past Chisholm's long-legged mule. Jamie kicked Gideon ungently in the ribs, urging him past the rest of the slow-moving travellers at a speed fast enough to keep the brute from biting, kicking, trampling stray bairns, or otherwise causing trouble. After a week's journey, he was all too well acquainted with the stallion's proclivities. He passed Brianna and Masali halfway up the column at a slow trot. By the time he passed Claire and Roger, riding at the head, he was moving too fast to do more than flourish his hat at them in salute.
"A vicar diable," he said, clapping the hat back on and leaning low over the horse's neck. "You're a deal too lively for your own good, let alone mine. See how long you last in the rough, eh?"
He pulled hard left, off the trail, and down the slope, trampling dry grass and brushing leafless dogwood out of the way with a gunshot snapping of twigs. What the seven-sided son of a bitch needed was flat country, where Jamie could gallop the bejesus out of him and bring him back blowing. Given that there wasn't a flat spot in 20 miles, he'd have to do the next best thing. He gathered up the reins, clicked his tongue, jabbed both heels into the horse's ribs, and they charged up the shrubby hillside as though they'd been fired from a cannon. Gideon was large-boned, well-nourished, and sound of wind, which was why Jamie had bought him. He was also a hard-mouthed, bad-tempered rister of a horse, which was why he hadn't cost much. More than Jamie could easily afford, even so. As they sailed over a small creek, jumped a fallen log, and haired up an almost vertical hillside littered with scrub oak and persimmon, Jamie found himself wondering whether he'd got a bargain or committed suicide. That was the last coherent thought he had before Gideon veered sideways, crushing Jamie's leg against a tree, then gathered his hindquarters and charged down the other side of the hill into a thicket of brush, sending coveys of quail exploding from under his huge flat hoofs. Half an hour of dodging low branches, lurching through streams and galloping straight up as many hillsides as Jamie could point them at, and Gideon was, if not precisely tractable, at least exhausted enough to be manageable. Jamie was soaked to the thighs, bruised, bleeding from half a dozen scratches, and breathing nearly as hard as the horse. He was, however, still in the saddle and still in charge.
He turned the horse's head toward the sinking sun and clicked his tongue again.
"Come on, then," he said. "Let's go home."
They had exerted themselves mightily, but given the rugged shape of the land, hadn't covered so much ground as to lose themselves entirely. He turned Gideon's head upward, and within a quarter hour had come out onto a small ridge he recognised. They picked their way along the ridge, searching for a safe way down through the tangles of chinkapin, poplar and spruce. The party wasn't far away, he knew, but it could take some time to cross to them,
and he would as soon rejoin them before they reached the ridge. Not that Claire or Mackenzie couldn't guide them, but he admitted to himself that he wished very much to return to Fraser's Ridge at the head of the party, leading his people home.
"Christ, man, you'd think you were Moses," he muttered,
shaking his head in mock dismay at his own pretensions. The horse was lathered, and when the trees opened out for a space, Jamie halted for a moment's rest, relaxing the reins, but keeping a sufficient grip as to discourage any notions the out-heedy creature might still be entertaining. They stood among a grove of silver birch at the lip of a small rocky outcrop above a 40-foot drop. He thought the horse held much too high an opinion of himself to contemplate self-destruction, but best to be careful in case he had any thought of flinging his rider off into the laurels below. The breeze was from the west. Jamie lifted his chin, enjoying the cold touch of it on his heated skin. The land fell away in undulating waves of brown and green, kindled here and there with patches of colour, lighting the mist in the hollows like the glow of campfire smoke. He felt a peace come over him at the sight, and breathed deep, his body relaxing. Gideon relaxed, too, all the feistiness draining slowly out of him like water from a leaky bucket. Slowly, Jamie let his hands drop lightly on the horse's neck, and the horse stayed still, ears forward. Ah, he thought, and the realization stole over him that this was a place. He thought of such places in a way that had no words, only recognizing one when he came to it. He might have called it holy, say that the feel of such a place had nothing to do with church or saint. It was simply a place he belonged to be, and that was sufficient, though he preferred to be alone when he found one. He let the reins go slack across the horse's neck. Not even a thrawn-minded creature like Gideon would give trouble here, he felt. Sure enough, the horse stood quiet, massive dark withers steaming in the chill. They couldn't tarry long, but he was deeply glad of the momentary respite, not from the battle with Gideon, but from the press of people. He had learned early on the trick of living separately in a crowd, private in his mind when his body couldn't be. But he was born a mountain dweller, and had learned early, too, the enchantment of solitude and the healing of quiet places.
This ends Disc 8. The Fiery Cross, Disc 9.
Quite suddenly, he had a vision of his mother, one of the small vivid portraits that his mind hoarded, producing them unexpectedly in response to God knew what. A sound, a smell, some passing freak of memory. He'd been snaring for rabbits on a hillside then, hot and sweaty, his fingers pricked with gorse, and his shirt stuck to him with mud and damp. He had seen a small grove of trees and gone to them for shade. His mother was there, sitting in the greenish shadow, on the ground beside a tiny spring. She sat quite motionless,
which was unlike her,
long hands folded in her lap. She hadn't spoken, but smiled at him, and he had gone to her, not speaking either, but filled with a great sense of peace and contentment, resting his head against her shoulder, feeling her arm go about him, and knowing he stood at the centre of the world. He'd been 5, maybe, or 6. As suddenly as it had come, the vision disappeared, like a bright trout vanishing into dark water. It left behind it the same deep sense of peace, though, as though someone had briefly embraced him. A soft hand touched his hair. He swung himself down from the saddle, needing the feel of the pine needles under his boots, some physical connection with this place. Caution made him tie the reins to a stout pine, though Gideon seemed calm enough. The stallion had dropped his head and was nuzzling for tufts of dried grass. Jamie stood still for a moment, then turned himself carefully to the right, facing the north. He no longer recalled who had taught him this, whether it was mother, father, or old John, Ian's father. He spoke the words, though, as he turned himself sunwise, murmuring the brief prayer to each of the four Erts in turn, and ended facing west into the setting sun. He cupped his empty hands, and the light filled them, spilling from his palms.
May God make safe to me each step. May God make open to me each pass. May God make clear to me each road. And may he take me in the clasp of his own two hands.
With an instinct older than the prayer, he took the flask from his belt and poured a few drops on the ground. Scraps of sound reached him on the breeze, laughter and calling, the sound of animals making their way through brush. The caravan wasn't far away, only across a small hollow, coming slowly round the curve of the hillside opposite. He should go now to join them on the last push upward to the ridge. Still he hesitated for a moment, loath to break the spell of the place. Some tiny movement caught the corner of his eye, and he bent down, squinting as he peered into the deepening shadows beneath a holly bush. It sat, frozen, bending perfectly with its dusky background. He would never have seen it had his hunter's eye not caught its movement. A tiny kitten, its grey fur puffed out like a ripe milkweed head, enormous eyes wide open and unblinking, almost colourless in the gloom beneath the bush. "A kite?" he whispered, putting out a slow finger toward it. "Whatever are you doing here?" "A feral cat, no doubt, born of a wild mother, fled from some settler's cabin, and long free of the trap of domesticity." He brushed the wispy fur of its breast, and it sank its tiny teeth suddenly into his thumb.
"Ow!"
He jerked away and examined the drop of blood welling from a small puncture wound. He glowered at the cat for a moment, but it merely stared back at him and made no move to run. He paused, then made up his mind. He shook the blood drop from his fingers onto the leaves, an offering to join the dram he had spilled, a gift to the spirits of this place, who had evidently made up their minds to offer him a gift themselves.
"All right, then," he said under his breath.
He knelt and stretched out his hand, palm up. Very slowly he moved one finger, then the next, and the next, and the next. Then again, in the undulant motion of seaweed in the water. The big pale eyes fixed on the movement, watching as though hypnotized. He could see the tip of the miniature tail twitch, very slightly, and smiled at the sight.
If he could guddle a trout, and he could, why not a cat?
He made a small noise through his teeth, a whistling hiss like the distant chittering of birds. The kitten stared, mesmerized, as the gently swaying fingers moved invisibly closer. When at last he touched its fur again, it made no move to escape. One finger edged beneath the fur, another slid under the cold wee pads of one paw, and it let him scoop it gently into his hand and lift it from the ground. He held it for a moment against his chest, stroking it with one finger, tracing the silken jawline, the delicate ears. The tiny cat closed its eyes and began to purr in ecstasy, rumbling in his palm like distant thunder.
"Oh, so you'll come away wi' me, will you?"
Receiving no demur from the cat, he opened the neck of his shirt and tucked the tiny thing inside, where it poked and prodded at his ribs for a bit before curling up against his skin, purr reduced to a silent but pleasant vibration. Gideon seemed pleased by the rest. He set off willingly enough, and within a quarter hour they had caught up with the others. The stallion's momentary docility evaporated, though, under the strain of the final upward climb. Not that the horse couldn't master the steep trail. What he couldn't abide was following another horse. It didn't matter whether Jamie wished to lead them home or not. If Gideon had anything to do with the matter, they would be not only in the lead, but several furlongs ahead. The column of travellers was strung out over half a mile, each family party travelling at its own speed. Frasers, Mackenzies, Chisholms, MacLeods, and Aberfeldies. At every space and widening of the trail, Gideon shouldered his way rudely ahead, shoving past pack mules, sheep, foot travellers, and mares. He even scattered the three pigs trudging slowly behind Granny Chisholm. The pigs bolted into the brush in a chorus of panicked oinks as Gideon bore down upon them. Jamie found himself more in sympathy with the horse than not, eager to be home and working hard to get there, irritated by anything that threatened to hold him back. At the moment, the main impediment to progress was Claire, who had, blast the woman, halted her mare in front of him and slid off in order to gather yet another bit of herbage from the trailside. As though the entire house wasn't filled from doorstep to roof tree with plants already, and her saddlebags abulge with more. Gideon, picking up his rider's mood with alacrity, stretched out his neck and nipped the mare's rump. The mare bucked, squealed, and shot off up the trail, loose reins dangling. Gideon made a deep, rumbling noise of satisfaction and started off after her, only to be jerked unceremoniously to a halt. Claire had whirled round at the noise, eyes wide. She looked up at Jamie, up the trail after her vanished horse, then back at him. She shrugged apologetically, hands full of tattered leaves and mangy roots. "Sorry," she said, but he saw the corner of her mouth tuck in and the flush rise in her skin, the smile glimmering in her eyes like morning light on trout water. Quite against his will, he felt the tension in his shoulders ease. He had had it in mind to rebuke her. In fact, he still did, but the words wouldn't quite come to his tongue. "Get up then, woman," he said instead, gruffly, with a nod behind him. "I want my supper." She laughed at him and scrambled up, kilting her skirts out of the way. Gideon, irascible at this additional burden, whipped round to take a nip of anything he could reach. Jamie was ready for that. He snapped the end of the rein sharply off the stallion's nose, making him jerk back and snort in surprise. "I'll teach you, you wee bastard." He pulled his hat over his brow and settled his errant wife securely, fluttering skirts tucked in beneath her thighs, arms round his waist. She rode without shoes or stockings, and her long calves were white and bare against the dark bay hide. He gathered up the reins and kicked the horse, a trifle harder than strictly necessary. Gideon promptly reared, backed, twisted, and tried to scrape them both off under a hanging poplar bough. The kitten, rudely roused from its nap, sank all its claws into Jamie's midsection and yowled in alarm, though its noise was quite lost in Jamie's much louder screech. He yanked the horse's head halfway round, swearing, and shoved at the hindquarters with his left leg. No easy conquest, Gideon executed a hop like a corkscrew. There was a small eek and a sudden feeling of emptiness behind him as Claire was slung off into the brush like a bag of flour. The horse suddenly yielded to the pull on his mouth and shot down the path in the wrong direction, hurtling through a screen of brambles and skidding to a halt that nearly threw him onto his hindquarters in a shower of mud and dead leaves. Then he straightened out like a snake, shook his head, and trotted nonchalantly over to exchange nuzzles with Roger's horse, which was standing at the edge of the spring clearing, watching them with the same bemusement exhibited by its dismounted rider. "All right there?" asked Roger, raising one eyebrow.
"Certainly," Jamie replied, trying to gasp for breath while keeping his dignity. "And you?"
"Fine."
"Good."
He was already swinging down from the saddle as he spoke. He flung the reins toward Mackenzie, not waiting to see whether he caught them, and ran back toward the trail, shouting,
"Claire, where are you?"
"Just here,"
she called cheerfully. She emerged from the shadow of the poplars, with leaves in her hair, and limping slightly, but looking otherwise undamaged.
"Are you all right?"
she asked, cocking one eyebrow at him.
"Aye, fine. I'm going to shoot that horse."
He gathered her in briefly, wanting to assure himself that she was, in fact, whole. She was breathing heavily, but felt reassuringly solid, and kissed him on the nose.
"Well, don't shoot him until we get home. I don't want to walk the last mile or so in my bare feet." "Hey, let that alone, you bugger."
He let go of Claire and turned to find Roger snatching a fist of ragged-looking plants away from Gideon's questing Roman nose. More plants. What was this mania for gathering? Claire was still panting from the accident, but leaned forward to see them, looking interested.
"What's that you've got, Roger?"
"Fabri,"
he said, holding them up for her inspection. Are they the right kind? To Jamie's jaundiced eye, they looked like the yellow tops of carrots gone to seed and left too long in the ground. But Claire fingered the mangy foliage and nodded approval.
Oh, yes, she said. Very romantic.
Jamie made a small, tactful noise, indicating that they ought perhaps to be making their way, since Bree and the slower-moving tribe of Chisholms would be catching them up soon.
Yes, all right, Claire said, patting his shoulder in what he assumed she meant to be a soothing gesture. Don't snort. We're going.
Mm-hmm, he said, and bent to put a hand under her foot. Tossing her up into the saddle, he gave Gideon a
don't try on, you bastard,
look, and swung up behind her.
You'll wait for the others, then, and bring them up.
Without waiting for Roger's nod, Jamie reined around and set Gideon upon the trail again. Mollified at being far in the lead, Gideon settled down to the job at hand, climbing steadily through the thickets of hornbeam and poplar, chestnut and spruce. Even so late in the year, some leaves still clung to the trees, and small bits of brown and yellow floated down upon them like a gentle rain, catching in the horse's mane, resting in the loose thick waves of Claire's hair. It had come down in her precipitous descent, and she hadn't bothered to put it up again. Jamie's own equanimity returned with a sense of progress, and was quite restored by the fortuitous finding of the hat he had lost, hanging from a white oak by the trail, as though placed there by some kindly hand. Still, he remained uneasy in his mind, and couldn't quite grasp tranquillity, though the mountain lay at peace all round him, the air hazed with blue and smelling of wood damp and evergreens. Then he realised, with a sudden jolt in the pit of his stomach, that the kitten was gone. There were itching furrows in the skin of his chest and abdomen, where it had climbed him in a frantic effort to escape, but it must have popped out the neck of his shirt and been flung off his shoulder in the mad career down the slope. He glanced from side to side, searching in the shadows under bushes and trees, but it was a vain hope. The shadows were lengthening, and they were on the main trail now, where he and Gideon had torn through the wood.
"Go with God," he murmured, and crossed himself briefly.
"What's that?"
Claire asked, half turning in the saddle.
"Nothing," he said.
After all, it was a wildcat, though a small one. Doubtless it would manage. Gideon worked the bit, pecking and bobbing. Jamie realised that the tension in his hands was running through the reins once more, and consciously slackened his grip. He loosened his grip on Claire, too, and she took a sudden deep breath. His heart was beating fast. It was impossible for him ever to come home after an absence without a certain sense of apprehension. For years after the rising, he had lived in a cave, approaching his own house only rarely, after dark, and with great caution, never knowing what he might find there. More than one Highland man had come back to his place to find it burned and black, his family gone. Or worse, still there. Well enough to tell himself not to imagine horrors, the difficulty was that he had no need of imagination. Memory sufficed. The horse dug with his haunches, pushing hard. No use to tell himself this was a new place. It was, with its own dangers. If there were no English soldiers in these mountains, there were still marauders, those too shiftless to take root and fend for themselves, but who wandered the back country, robbing and plundering. Raiding Indians, wild animals, and fire. Always fire. He had sent the Bugs on ahead with Fergus to guide them, to save Claire dealing with the simultaneous chores of arrival and hospitality. The Chisholms, the MacLeods, and Billy Aberfeldy, with his wife and wee daughter, would all bide with them at the big house for a time. He had told Mrs. Bug to begin cooking at once. Decently mounted, and not hindered by children or livestock, the Bug should have reached the ridge 2 days before. No one had come back to say aught was amiss, so perhaps all was well. But still, he hadn't realised that Claire was tensed too, until she suddenly relaxed against him, a hand on his leg.
It's all right, she said. I smell chimney smoke.
He lifted his head to catch the air.
She was right. The tang of burning hickory floated on the breeze. Not the stink of remembered conflagration, but a homely whiff redolent with a promise of warmth and food. Mrs. Bug had presumably taken him at his word.
They rounded the last turn of the trail and saw it then. The high fieldstone chimney rising above the trees on the ridge, its fat plume of smoke curling over the roof tree. The house stood.
He breathed deep in relief, noticing now the other smells of home, the faint rich scent of manure from the stable, of meat smoked and hanging in the shed, and the breath of the forest nearby, damp wood and leaf rot, rock and rushing water, the touch of it cold and loving on his cheek. They came out of the chestnut grove and into the large clearing where the house stood, solid and neat, its windows glazed gold with the last of the sun. It was a modest frame house, whitewashed and shingle-roofed, clean in its lines and soundly built, but impressive only by comparison with the crude cabins of most settlers. His own first cabin still stood, dark and sturdy, a little way down the hill. Smoke was curling from that chimney too. "Someone's made a fire for Bree and Roger," Claire said, nodding at it. "That's good," he said.
He tightened his arm about her waist, and she made a small, contented noise in her throat, wriggling her bottom into his lap.
Gideon was happy too. He stretched out his neck and whinnied to the two horses in the penfold, who trotted to and fro in the enclosure, calling greetings. Claire's mare was standing by the fence, reins dangling.
She curled her lip in what looked like derision, the wee bism. From somewhere far down the trail behind them came a deep, joyous bray.
Clarence the mule, hearing the racket and delighted to be coming home. The door flew open and Mrs. Bug popped out, round and flustered as a tumble-turd. Jamie smiled at sight of her and gave Claire an arm to slide down before dismounting himself.
"All's well, all's well, and how's yourself, sir?" Mrs. Bug was reassuring him before his boots struck ground. She had a pewter cup in one hand, a polishing cloth in the other, and didn't cease her polishing for an instant, even as she turned up her face to accept his kiss on her withered, round cheek. She didn't wait for an answer, but turned at once and stood a tiptoe to kiss Claire, beaming.
"Oh, it's grand that you're home, ma'am, you and himself. And I've the supper all made, so you'll not be worried a bit with it, ma'am. But come inside and be taking off those dusty clouts, and I'll send old Arch along to the mash house for a bit of the lively, and we'll..."
She had Claire by one hand towing her into the house, talking and talking, the other hand still polishing briskly away, her stubby fingers dexterously rubbing the cloth inside the cup. Claire gave him a helpless glance over one shoulder, and he grinned at her as she disappeared inside the house.
Gideon shoved an impatient nose under his arm and bumped his elbow. "Oh, aye," he said, recalled to his chores. "Come along then, you prickly wee bastard."
By the time he had the big horse and Claire's mare unsaddled, wiped down, and turned out to their feed, Claire had escaped from Mrs. Bug. Coming back from the paddock, he saw the door of the house swing open and Claire slip out, looking guiltily over her shoulder as though fearing pursuit. Where was she bound? She didn't see him. She turned and hurried toward the far corner of the house, disappearing in a swish of homespun. He followed, curious.
Ah, she had seen to her surgery. Now she was going to her garden before it got completely dark.
He caught a glimpse of her against the sky on the upward path behind the house, the last of the daylight caught like cobwebs in her hair. There would be little growing now, only a few sturdy herbs and the overwintering things like carrots and onions and turnips. But it made no difference. She always went to see how things were, no matter how short a time she'd been away. He understood the urge. He wouldn't feel entirely home himself until he had checked all the stock and buildings and made sure of matters up at the still.
The evening breeze brought him an acrid hint from the distant privy, suggesting that matters there were shortly going to require his attention, speaking of buildings.